أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله سليم، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. I'd like to express our condolences first and foremost to the beloved Imam of our time and to all the believers, all the brothers and sisters throughout the globe, and the brothers and sisters here. We've been trying to understand what transpired between the demise of the Holy Prophet and the Khilafah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, or in other words, the time that he was actually given government and he was able to rule. What happened during this time that when the best ruler, the most just ruler you could imagine, the most competent leader you could imagine, comes to lead these people, we see that in a matter of 4 years and 9 months, that government comes to an end with the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Of course, the government carries on for another extra 6 months with Imam al-Mujtaba, but after 6 months, Imam al-Mujtaba has to hand it over and allow for Muawiyah to lead. What happens here? And the reason why we selected this discussion, this topic to cover, is because this month is the time and the month of change for us to look at our lives, our thought process, the way we make decisions, and do a real tawbah this month. Tawbah means I want to change the direction in my life from what it is and bring it back on track and where it needs to be. So in this month, we want to benefit from this to learn what we're supposed to do, inshallah, to better ourselves. What we try to describe, and I hope to a good extent we've been able to, is to show how gradually, with decisions that were made, beginning with leadership itself, and having someone other than who the Holy Prophet had appointed for leadership lead, then the character of those leaders, particularly we focused on the second Khalifa, and how eventually the decisions made by that Khalifa caused for there to be a class of wealthy individuals, the people that used to be during the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, on the front lines fighting, people that used to be giving their lives, giving what they owned, sacrificing all of that for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These were the family of the Holy Prophet, the close companions of the Holy Prophet, most of whom were with the Prophet in Mecca, then in Medina. These people that were the ones that the Quran says, the people that joined the Prophet before Fath, before the conquest of Mecca, before the Holy Prophet went to Medina, those were very difficult times. It says that these people are not comparable to the others that came after. Because others that joined later on, they came when there was ease. It's easy. Now becoming Muslim has become a fad. Everybody's becoming Muslim. Right? That's not difficult. When it was difficult, when they were being persecuted, when they were being put in Sha'bu Abi Talib, going for days, weeks, months without food, without proper drinking water, struggling, having to have molded bread probably. God knows what those circumstances were like. Believers that were in those circumstances, believers that in the initial days of Medina, with all the difficulties and the battles they had to fight, these people that created the or formed the people around the Holy Prophet, that allowed for everything else to happen, for others to come, and these people became the role models that people looked up to, these same people gradually, starting at the time, the latter part of the rule of the second Khalifa, when he started to distribute that fay, the anfal, the zakat, in ways other than what the Holy Prophet had said. Through giving these people the privileges, giving them of the fay constantly and continuously, they started forming the upper class. So these people that were the ones that kept everybody moving towards the Akhirah, now they started becoming those that, except for a few like Amirul Mu'mineen, like Salman, like Miqdad, like Abu Dhar, like Ammar, except for these exceptions, the rest of the companions of the Holy Prophet were seen to be going with the flow, some of them even being in the forefront, leading others in that direction. And gradually, as we said, the movement became in this way, that everybody wanted to go towards Shahada during the time of the Holy Prophet. Everybody was thinking of the Akhirah. Gradually, over the course of these 25 years, gradually it came such that people, the driving force that would drive people would be the dunya. We tried to describe this and we tried to explain. It is for this reason, in this culture, that Amirul Mu'mineen was in at the time when he became the Khalifa. He was given that rule. It's because of this, but during that time, when you look at the words of the Imam, most of what you find as emphasis is going to be about the dunya. Most of it is about that. A lot of descriptions are given by Amirul Mu'mineen, and you've heard many. His words, the way he dressed, the way he ate, the way he traveled, all of that was to go against this. Now, let's not forget, we mentioned that we wanted to explain how the problems developed such that the people that at the time of the Holy Prophet were all following the Haqq, even if they had to sacrifice for it. During the time of Amirul Mu'mineen, it reached a stage that these people didn't want to follow the Haqq that Amirul Mu'mineen was representing. Not only that, they actually went to the extent of assassinating Amirul Mu'mineen. What led to all of this? Now we can kind of and sort of understand this culture, and it is problematic. We sort of understand that. But can we get into a bit more detail of how this leads to that? What happens that if you have a society, if you have a community, and let's not forget, we were discussing this in order to benefit from it, for our communities, for our families, and us as individuals. All of that is intended. And let's not forget, we are part of a global community of Muslims. This is very important for us to learn from. We are currently in those very same circumstances with some differences. Some of the names have changed, but a lot of what is happening around you, a lot of what is happening around us resembles that time. And I don't need to explain how that is. Just keep that in mind. Don't think we're talking about something that is irrelevant to our lives. No, it's very, very relevant. Okay. How does a culture of a people being more interested and driven by the dunya, being driven by desires, as Amir al-Mu'mineen said, اتباعُ الْهَوَىٰ, how does that lead to people فَيَصُدُّ عَنْ الْحَقِّ, as the Imam said? It keeps people from moving towards the haqq. It prevents haqq from happening. Now, on a personal level, I think we started explaining that in one of the earlier sessions. We talked about that. But on a social level, on a community level, how does this happen? That when you have a community or a society moving in that direction, if you have the best leader, the wisest, most just leader that wants to change things back to what they were, people are not going to allow that to happen. I don't know if we see the resemblance, one of the dimensions, only one of the dimensions of how this relates to us and an understanding we need to have for our day and age. We have to understand and realize, brothers and sisters, that the culture of the world we live in today, spearheaded by the West, and particularly the United States, the culture that is here, and it's being taken to the other parts of the world, is that very same culture. Everybody is driven by material gains and material benefits. Pretty much everybody, that's the culture. When you want to give incentives to people to do things, the incentives are also going to be material incentives. For example, this is only an example, sometimes when they want to have people donate towards Islamic activities that we are all in need of, one of the things that needs to be said, for instance, is that you can receive a receipt, this will go towards your tax deduction. If you pay the money here, then you're not going to be paying that much taxes. So instead of paying the taxes to the government, you are going to be paying that money here. So you'll think to yourself, okay, this is not a bad idea. It's not a bad deal. Okay, I'm going to be paying it anyway. All right. So that instead of it being paid to the government, because I will not get any recognition or anything, I can pay it to the center. And that way I can get a name too, by the way. Okay. And they'll say, this guy donated this much. Sometimes the incentive is it being mentioned. Unfortunately, alhamdulillah, I haven't seen it here, but I have been in centers where I've had to control myself, because they actually say, if you want your marhum's name to be mentioned, you have to pay this much. Everything is, we're living in this type of culture, all right? If Amir al-Mu'mineen wanting to change a people that for 25 years had moved towards from being driven by the akhirah, their inclinations being spiritual, to a people that were more inclined towards the dunya, if he was unable in 4 years and 9 months to bring people back on track, do you think it'll be possible, if the Imam of our time would come today, for him to bring the global community back on track? This is why the imam is in occultation. This is why the imam is in occultation. And that's why, this is one of the reasons I'm saying that this is very relevant to us. It's one of the reasons. But on a lower scale in our communities also, this is something that's very important. What is it that causes a community that's moving in that direction when you have a just leader coming in, they're not able to bring it back on track? You can apply that to your local community. Now, inshallah, everything here is moving in the right direction. But let's say, if you live in one of those communities, that the direction that the community has taken is that of material gain, material benefit. If you expect somebody to come in and to be able to bring that community back on track, it's going to be very difficult, and there are going to be a lot of challenges on that way. And it's very likely that that's not going to happen, depending on how the people are going to deal with this situation. So understanding this is going to be very important. How does this culture prevent the community, prevent the society from going back on the right tracks? How does this happen? Amir al-Mu'min explains this in the khutbah that we started off on. But I need to explain, before I read that line, I need to explain. There were two different groups of people during the time, and in any community, in any society, we can divide people up into two groups. All right? We can divide people up into two groups. You have one group of people that are the privileged in a society. They are the ones that have the funds. They are the ones that have the money. They were the ones that have the financial means to do things. Then you have a group of people that don't have, they're not that well off. They're not doing too good. You can pretty much classify, yeah, there's a middle class there as well, usually they say. But we'll put the middle class with the people that are a bit more privileged. And then you have the average person that's not all that privileged in a society that has actually moved in that direction, where you have a larger upper class, or you have the people that you have in the upper class very wealthy, very affluent, and then you have a lower class, and there's barely anybody there in the middle. Okay. Sometimes societies move in that direction, and some are saying the Western society is actually moving in that direction right now as well. You have these two different classes, okay? So during the time of the Khulafa, before Amir al-Mu'mineen becomes the Khalifa, you have these two. The culture that has been created is that everybody is inclined towards desires. There's ittiba'ul hawa, and there is the long wishes. As the Imam said, the amal, you have those. Everybody is involved with that. But these two different groups are very different when it comes to a leader coming in and wanting to change things. Right? It's very different. How so? If you look at the lower class, when Amir al-Mu'mineen came in, when Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayh took government, if you look at the lower class and just think to yourself, if the previous governments were taking the money that was rightfully belonging to this lower class and giving it to people that they created as the upper class, now if you have a just ruler coming in and is going to fix things up, take from those people that got wealthy on things that they didn't have any right to, and give it to people that had the right to it, if you have that situation, who's going to benefit from that? Well, obviously, the lower class is going to benefit from that. They're inclined towards their desires, yes. They're not all thinking about the akhirah. They're not all thinking about the hereafter, God, and all those great things. No, they're not thinking of that. But even from a material perspective, is it in the interest of the lower class to have a just person rule over them that is going to give them what's rightfully theirs? Or is it better for them to have the unjust rulers that's going to give the privileged more and more, get them fattened up, give them more gold and so on and so forth, and these people are going to be underprivileged. Obviously. Pretty obvious. I don't think we need to ask that question. In fact, that's the reason why the less privileged at the time of the third Khalifa revolted. Who do you think came to Medina? Initially, of course. Who came to Medina protesting against the decisions of the third Khalifa? People from Kufa, people from Egypt. Some of them came because they were inclined towards Akhira, like Malik al-Ashtar, like Ammar ibn Yasir, like some of the people that came from Egypt. These people came because they had a problem, not that their pockets were empty, not that they had been suffering, but because they saw that this is wrong religiously, this is wrong Islamically, this is wrong from a human perspective. This is wrong. What's happening is wrong. Those were their intentions, those were their motives, that's why they came. But the masses that came with them, the people that were the most fired up in that scene, were people that were underprivileged, people that were suffering, people that weren't getting their share. They were the ones that were revolting. So for them, the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen would be something which is good. And if you're telling me that a small upper class, in terms of numbers, the number of people that are in the upper class are not a very large number, it's predominantly at the time of Uthman, it becomes the relatives of Uthman and those who've been able to get closer to them, they're the upper class. If you look at that, then you think, all right, the masses, majority should be supporting Amir al-Mu'mineen, and you have a smaller number, which are the privileged, they're going to be fighting Amir al-Mu'mineen. How is it that Amir al-Mu'mineen isn't able to take the society back on track? Well, things happen here, brothers and sisters. Things happen. What is it that's going to happen? The ones that are going to be harmed by this, the ones that are not going to receive the privileges at the time, or the ones that they were receiving at the time of the previous Khulafa, now with Ali, they're not going to be receiving it, they're not going to be okay with it, right? It's pretty obvious. But what are they going to do about it? Amir al-Mu'mineen tells us. Recite a salawat, please. He says, إِنَّمَا بَدْءُ وُقُوعِ الْفِتَنْ أَهْوَاءٌ تُتَّبَعُ. At the beginning of any fitna, there are desires that are followed. What happened after the Khilafah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Battle of Jamal, the Battle of Siffin, the Battle of Nahrawan, all of these are fitna. Okay. These are all referred to as fitna. He describes what fitna is. إِنَّمَا بَدْءُ وُقُوعِ الْفِتَنْ مِنْ أَهْوَاءٍ تُتَّبَعُ. There are going to be desires. Let me translate that into that context, because it's important for us to have that understanding before we can get the rest of what Amir al-Mu'mineen says. Who are the privileged of the society that Amir al-Mu'mineen is ruling over? Who are the privileged? We mentioned over and over again over the course of these last couple of nights that the privileged, the ones that became materialistically privileged, financially privileged, by the end of the term of the third Khalifa, were the same people that were the closest companions and family members of the Holy Prophet. We mentioned this yesterday. That's how people were divided up. If you're the family of the Holy Prophet, if you're Sayyid, you're going to receive special privileges, more cash, more money. If you're one of the people that fought in Badr, you're going to get extra privileges. If you're the wife of the Prophet, you're going to get privileges. So these individuals, if you look at it, they have two dimensions to them. One of them is their cash. One of them is their financial well-being. But the other one is having a religious image to them. They're seen as religious people. They are seen as religiously good people in the society that they live in. They're not only considered, it's not like the people you have here. When you look at the upper class in America, you don't give them any type of respect from a religious perspective, do you? There's no religious respect you would give to anyone. You don't give any religious respect to the president of this country. You don't give any religious respect to any of the Congress men or women. You don't give any religious respect to them. They don't have any religious respect. But at that time, the individuals that had those privileges that are now going to be harmed by the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen, they are considered religiously good people. They are referred to as the companions of the Holy Prophet. They are referred to as people that know the knowledge of the Holy Prophet. They are the people that are given the podium. They are the people that are given the pulpits to speak to people and explain to people what their religion is all about. Okay, let's keep that into perspective. Let's bring that into perspective. It's important for us to make note of this. These people, and let's focus right now on the religious image they have in society. These people who are considered very religious people, they're considered very good people. On top of being wealthy, they're considered very good people. They want to, or they're having a problem with who? With Amir al-Mu'mineen. When they have a problem with Amir al-Mu'mineen, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, obviously, if he wants to change things and bring it back where it was, he's going to give the people what is haq. People are not going to follow that. What is that called? It's called ittiba'u al-hawa. So he says, innama bad'u wuqu'u al-fitan min ahwa'in tuttaba. But who is following these desires? People that are in our day and age. People that have probably turbans on their heads. Okay, this is how we would see them in this day and age. People that are worshipping in the masajid. People that have huge sajda marks on their foreheads. People that have a lot of religious respect. These people are the ones that are now having an issue with Amir al-Mu'mineen. They're following their ahwa. They're following their desires. Why am I insisting on this so much? Why am I keep repeating this? The reason is because of the religious respect that they have, the religious image they have, they are seen to be as pious people. People don't think that this individual is saying what he's saying because of his desires. They think what he's going to be saying is that he's the companion of the Holy Prophet. He's the wife of the Holy Prophet. She's the wife of the Holy Prophet. He is this, he is that. He participated in this battle and so on and so forth. Oh, it's a Mawlana. It's a Mu'ammam, it's a Sayyid in our day and age. To see that this person, with all the religious respect they've been able to earn because of some history they've had, and of course some people don't even have that history, it's simply because of lineage that they have it. To understand that this person is following their ahwa, their desire. That's what's actually driving them. That's what the driving force is. Recite a salawat, please. He says, وَأَحْكَامٌ تُبْتَدَعُ. If a religious person that is seen to be the voice of the religion, someone who's been with the Holy Prophet, or in our day and age, someone who's studied religion, he's considered a Hujjatul Islam, or a Maulana, or a Shaykh, or a whatever, an Ayatollah even. If this Ayatollah, or this Shaykh, or this Hujjatul Islam, wants to follow his desires in a community that is somewhat, even superficially, driven by religion, the underlying factors, what really drives people is the material, but superficially religion is important. So if he wants to get people to move in a certain direction, what is he going to do? أَحْكَامٌ تُبْتَدَعُ. There's going to be fabrications that are going to come. Fabrication of the sayings of the Holy Prophet, attributing things to the Holy Prophet that he did not say. This is what's going to happen. Attributing things to the Holy Prophet by misinterpreting a saying of the Holy Prophet. There's an example, you might have heard it from me before, for this particular one. It says when Amir al-Mu'mineen sent his people, Imam al-Mujtaba, Ammar ibn Yasir, and others to Kufa to try to gather troops. For which battle? For the first battle, the Battle of Jamal. Zubayr, Talha, Aisha, all these people had gathered their forces. They'd come, they'd move towards Basra. They set up their camp over there. Amir al-Mu'mineen kept on warning them when he saw that, no, they're going to be doing this. They took action, practical measures against the government. They destabilized the Islamic government. They killed individuals. They took control of the treasury in Basra. They took control of the city of Basra. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, we need to fight them. So he called for people to come. One of the cities that they went to gather troops is Kufa. They go to the Masjid of Kufa. Imam al-Mujtaba, salamullah alayh. Gives a talk and he explains to the people why they need to go and what is happening, describing the scene, why there needs to be troops, and encouraging them to join and go and fight alongside Amir al-Mu'mineen against his enemies, the people of Jamal. Imam al-Mujtaba does that. When Imam al-Mujtaba gives the talk, what happens? There's a person that is seen as a companion of the Holy Prophet. Who is it? Someone that none of you today have any respect for. So when I mention his name, some of you will be thinking, why did people even listen to this man? Well, the reason why you're thinking that is because you're thinking and you're understanding him as you do today. You're not living in the society that he lived then. Who is it? It's Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari is known as a companion of the Holy Prophet. He's someone that probably has a pretty big beard. Okay. He looks very religious. He's got one of those huge sajda marks on his forehead as well. He's seen as someone that leads prayers. In Kufa, he's very reputable. He has a lot of respect. In fact, let me add to that. When Malik al-Ashtar came to Medina, at the time of Uthman, Malik al-Ashtar was one of the people that came to Medina and was part of the rebellion against Uthman. Before they came to Medina, they already had a rebellion against the governor of Uthman in Kufa. And they had actually taken control of the government of Kufa. The governor that Uthman had appointed for Kufa was no longer ruling and leading in Kufa. So who was leading? Who did Malik al-Ashtar and others put as the one who was going to govern Kufa? Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. So just imagine this scene. There's been an uprising against injustice in Kufa. The governor of Kufa has been removed. Who's been put in place of him? Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. So he already had the respect of being the companion of the Holy Prophet, being very religious, being pious, being involved and engaged in worship and prayer, having the knowledge of the Quran and the religion. Now, in addition to all of that, the people that revolted against injustice thought that he's the best fit to rule. Now, when the son of Amir al-Mu'mineen comes, Imam al-Mujtaba comes and he delivers the talk, just imagine what these words are going to do. What did he say? He says, I heard from the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. I heard him say, after me, there will be a fitna. There will be a fitna that you should not take a stance on. You should not take any sides. Keep quiet. Remain silent. This is that fitna. Amongst the believers, there is war going on. This is fitna. You shouldn't take any sides. Both parties are Muslim. This is a fitna. Don't take any sides. And it sounds very familiar to me in this day and age. When the two parties that are involved in something similar to a war or a battle, then people kind of distance themselves from both of them and they try to think that, okay, I'm not going to take any sides here. That's exactly what Abu Musa al-Ash'ari said. Okay, and he said the Prophet of Islam said this to him. So when you're looking at that, he's a companion of the Holy Prophet. He says he heard the Holy Prophet say this. Is he lying? What's going on here? Because of the desires of this man, he's interpreting the words of the Holy Prophet in this way. Ammar ibn Yasir is there. He stands up and he wants to explain. He wants to clarify what the Holy Prophet actually meant, if those are his words. You know what he said? It's interesting. Ammar ibn Yasir stood up and he said to Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, yes, the Holy Prophet said that don't take a stance. There will be a fitna. Don't speak. Remain silent. All right? But he said that to you. He told you to be quiet. He told you to remain silent and say nothing. You just went against what he said. By taking the stance and saying what you just said, you caused people not to join Amir al-Mu'mineen. You helped the other side. Okay. The Holy Prophet had apparently said that to him. For his own good, to save his own neck, he took that word, misinterpreted it, flipped it, and said it applies to everybody to try to get people not to go with Amir al-Mu'mineen. When you have someone that has that religious respect, if it wasn't for another companion of the Holy Prophet, Ammar ibn Yasir, that had to do a lot of this at that time, to clarify that this is ahkamun tubtada. It's either something attributed falsely to the Holy Prophet, the wording even of it is falsely attributed, or the interpretation of it is falsely attributed to the Holy Prophet. The Holy Prophet meant something completely different. But when it comes from someone with that religious respect, it's difficult to note. That's what the Imam continues to say. He says, وَأَحْكَامٌ تُبْتَدَعْ يُخَالَفُ فِيهَا حُكْمُ اللَّهِ. In a fitna, the hukm of Allah, the verdict of God, is something that they go against. They don't follow God's order. يَتَوَلَّ فِيهَا رِجَالٌ رِجَالًا. This is something we're going to focus on a bit, inshallah, when we get the time. There will be some people that are going to lead, and then there's going to be those that are going to follow that. يَتَوَلَّ فِيهَا رِجَالٌ. Some people, some men, are going to follow others, رِجَالًا. Ala, then he explains further what I just described, sort of. In a different wording, he says, Ala inna al-haqqa law khalas lam yakun ikhtilaf. This is one of those golden statements of Amir al-Mu'mineen that applies to us. Look, it's easy when there are these differences. It's easy to just say, look, I don't know what's going on. I'm not going to take a stand, sit down, sit back, relax, let things be handled by others. I don't want to get myself involved. It's easy to do that, but it's not necessarily right to do that. One of the concepts that comes to mind, one of the thoughts that comes to mind that causes people not to be able to take any sides is this, that both sides are religious, both sides have ulama supporting them, and they get confused. Amir al-Mu'mineen says this, look, when you understand disputes like this, لو كان لو أن الحق or أن الحق in this state or in this wording of it, because there's another hadith in Al-Kafi, in the earlier chapters of Al-Kafi. It seems to be the same sermon, but the wording of it is slightly different. Here it says, أَلَا إِنَّ الْحَقَّ لَوْ خَلَصْ لَمْ يَكُنْ اِخْتِلَافٍ. If everybody was right, there would be no dispute. If both are trying to do what's religiously right, and nobody's really trying to do religiously wrong, they would not be fighting. There may have difference of opinion, but fighting is not going to be going on. If you have fighting going on, then no, somebody here is doing something wrong. إِنَّ الْحَقَّ لَوْ خَلَصْ لَمْ يَكُنْ إِخْتِلَافٌ وَلَوْ أَنَّ الْبَاطِلَ خَلَصْ لَمْ يُخَفْ عَلَى ذِي حِجَةٍ. He says, look, if batil was presented to you, and it was only batil, anyone with an intellect would be able to identify this is wrong. There would be no problem. You wouldn't have يتولى فيها رجال رجالا. You wouldn't have a people following another group of people. The masses wouldn't follow that. Why? Because anyone with an intellect would know this is wrong, this is right. We will follow the haq. No issue. No problem. But no, it's not pure batil. They're not going to give you lies only. The media is not going to give you lies 24/7. Every single thing that they're going to tell you is going to be lies. No, don't expect that. When people tell you that you need to be careful about what the media is presenting to you, it's not that they're saying every single thing that they say is a lie. If they would have done that, nobody would follow that news. Except for people that are a little dumb. That may be the reason why certain channels have that type of people following them. Okay. I think one of the channels I can mention is Fox. I mean, you got to be pretty dumb not to be able to tell. But if you expect the BBC to come out and give you all lies, no, they're very clever. They'll give you 99 truths to give you that one lie to move you in the direction that they want. Okay. They're there to push or to take the intelligent people in the wrong direction, not the dumb ones. You have Fox News for them. Okay. BBC, I was in a, and it's going to take a bit of time, but it's important, I think. People think we're a bit extremist when we say this. Well, believe me, I'm just giving you my observations. I was in an interfaith program in Scotland, and it was about misconceptions. I was supposed to talk about misconceptions about Islam. There was a Christian priest that was supposed to be talking about misconceptions about the Bible and Christianity. I thought to myself to take advantage of that time, before talking about the misconceptions about Islam, talk about the source of those misconceptions, and that those misconceptions are not, and those sources are not spreading misconceptions and misunderstandings about Islam only. They are spreading misinformation against all religions. There's a war a campaign, a media campaign against religion in its entirety and religious doctrines, the ones that are more orthodox. They want to push them aside or change them. So I explained that. I try to give examples of that. There was a lady in the audience. She was getting really upset. This is a Christian lady in Scotland, older as well. And after my talk, she interjected in the middle of the talk. And partially she was right because I went over my time. Well, I had told one of the brothers to signal to me when the time is up, but he didn't do so. So I went over my time. I sat down. But after the program, she came over again. And she said, these were a bunch of lies you just said, and so on and so forth. I said, so what news channel do you watch? I started with ones, you know, in Britain, one of the news channels that is similar to Fox, similar, is Sky, okay, Sky News. I said, what do you watch, Sky News? She said, no, with pride. I don't watch Sky News, no. This, that, a few examples, she said, no, I don't watch any of that. So I was thinking, okay, so what does she watch? She said, oh, I watch the BBC. I was like, oh, and that's really good. That's the mother of all evil. That's the best news channel that can push you in the wrong direction and you wouldn't even know. They have been able to control public opinion better than any other news agency in the world. They're the best at it. The British are the best, I mean, by far. Especially the BBC. To the extent that British citizens, not only British citizens, Muslims in the Muslim world trust the BBC more than Muslim news agencies. And they think it's justified. I say to myself, SubhanAllah. How does this happen? People trust disbelievers, non-believers that are fighting Islam, that are killing Muslims, that have done so for centuries in India, in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Arabia. They've killed people in America. They've oppressed people throughout the globe. Their news agency that they fund is more trustworthy than believers. Thank you very much. I know. They're not going to give you lies only. If they would, as Amir al-Mu'mineen says, whenever you see a dispute, don't think that everybody's telling the truth, everybody's saying what's right. No, if they're adamant about it and it's leading to war, leading to conflict, not everybody's being truthful here. You got to know that. And the one who's actually giving the lies is not going to only give you lies. They're not going to only give you lies. وَلَوْ أَنَّ الْبَاطِلَ خَلَصْ لَمْ يُخَفْ عَلَى ذِي حِجَةٍ لَكِنَّهُ يُؤْخَذْ مِنْ هَذَا ضِغْثٌ وَمِنْ هَذَا ضِغْثٌ فَيُمْزَجَانْ فَهُنَالِكَ يَسْتَوْلِ الشَّيْطَانُ عَلَى أَوْلِيَائِهِ. They take a bit of the truth and a bit of the false, they mix it up and present it to you, and he says that this is going to be a very difficult situation, a very difficult time to make your decisions. And what's actually going to happen is that Shaytan is going to now, in this atmosphere of confusion, is going to take over the people that he is in control of. يَسْتَوْلِي الشَّيْطَانُ عَلَىٰ أَوْلِيَائِهِ. Which requires further explanation. Inshallah, I'll try to give that in the following session. Today was the day of the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Salamullah alayhi. These are very sad moments, very sad hours and days for the family of our beloved Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah alayh, this man of justice, this man of taqwa and piety, this man who did everything in his capacity to try to help the people that he was ruling over, the family of this man are now in a situation where they've lost their father, they've lost their loved one. It was this morning, brothers and sisters, it says that before Fajr, it was late at night, in the middle of the night, that Amir al-Mu'mineen, Mawla al-Muwahideen, was able to meet his Lord and relieve himself or be relieved of the difficulties of this world. I think to myself, and I truly believe this, when I look at that, I don't know if you've noticed, the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen is not very sad news for me. The life of Amir al-Mu'mineen and what he went through is very sad. The time of his shahada is when he's relieved of all those difficulties and hardships. The time of his shahada is the time that he leaves that community that did not have that respect for him. He would go to the homes of the widows of Kufa in the middle of the night, at nighttime, where he was not recognized. He was not seen as Ali ibn Abi Talib, the ruler. He would be seen as someone that is dressed in somewhat raggedy clothes that's coming in and trying to help. He would go there, prepare the ovens, bake the bread for them, play with the children, and hear that widow cursing Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi. This is the pain, this is the ghurba, the madlumiyyah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi. Would like to say a few salams to the Imam before the matam begins, and we'll hand over the mic to the brothers that are going to recite the poetry, and the brothers will be responding to that with their latm and matam, inshallah. Let's all take our hearts to Najaf, the beautiful shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The shrine that one truly feels at home in. If you haven't been, you should really ask the Imam on this night to give you the tawfiq to go. Honestly, the first time I went, it was an amazing experience. When you, in the streets, Shara' al-Rasul, move towards the Haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen, suddenly you see the beautiful dome of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and you pause for a moment. You feel different. When you go into the Haram, the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, all you want to do is you feel at home. You would like to speak to the Imam. Consider yourselves there, and we'll say a few salams, inshallah. As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt an-nubuwwah. As-salamu alayk ya awwal mazlum. السلام عليك أيها الشهيد. السلام عليك. I want to call him something that I haven't heard said about him. We usually say this about Imam al-Ridha, but I want to say it about Amir al-Mu'mineen. As-salamu alayka ya ghareeb al-ghuraba. Amir al-Mu'mineen is lonely and ghareeb in the city of Medina, amongst the companions of the Holy Prophet, who used to love the Holy Prophet. After the demise of the Holy Prophet, Amir al-Mu'mineen and everyone who was around him was abandoned, all because of Ali. If you hear, certain mistreatments were given to the lady Fatima al-Zahra, it was because she was defending Ali. Not even 10 or 20 people came to support him. After the lady Fatima al-Zahra tried to protect Amir al-Mu'mineen, and she gave her life in that way, Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't even have the wife he had that he could go to and speak to. Some say when times were difficult, Amir al-Mu'mineen would be struggling with difficulties. He had no one to speak to. He would go to the well in the middle of the night, stick his head in the well, talk about his issues, problems he was facing. In Kufa, the Imam is gharib, he's lonely. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون.
يا لي مولا. Brothers and sisters, we have very limited time and we have a four, actually five reciter. So please stay on the schedule.